Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well, thanks, James. And your article a couple of weeks ago, Mitt Romney, the Artful Dodger at Forbes, it looks as though Mitt Romney is trying to successfully dodge the debate about his taxes and how much money he hid offshore. And do you think that he's going to get away with it? He seems like he's laid down a marker that I'm simply not going to talk about this anymore. And do you think he's going to be successful?
Well, I think it depends on how many hard questions people ask him and whether they keep up the demand. You know, there's no explanation for why he isn't revealing these returns. It's virtually unprecedented. He's only released the 2010 return, and that was, of course, prepared after he decided to run. And there's a lot of speculation about what he could possibly be hiding. You know, the IRS had a program for, in the wake of the UBS bank investigation in 2009, the IRS initiated a amnesty program for people who came in and wanted to voluntarily clean up their mistakes in the past. So there's some speculation that he may have been one of the people who enrolled in that program between March 2009 and October of 2009. We just don't know. You know, and the key point is that this would be the first time in U.S. Election history for a presidential candidate not to share with the public at least a half dozen or so of his tax returns. So,
well, but he's shared 23 years of his tax returns with John McCain when he was a possible vice presidential pick for McCain.
But at that point we didn't have the 2009 return. That was 2008. The interesting thing I'm suggesting is that there's something in the 2009 return that's caused him to draw a line.
I see. So the fact that Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate leader, has come out and said that he got a call from somebody, an investor in Bain, who said that Romney didn't pay taxes for 10 years. Is that, obviously he's obviously very partisan, Reid. But on the other hand, he's not exactly reckless. So do you think he has something?
Well, I have no idea. You know, let's just put it to him. And I think, again, we shouldn't exaggerate the partisan issue here. I mean, organization I work with is not affiliated with any political party. We are an independent organization that's just interested in cleaning up tax havens. And
that's the Tax Justice Network, right?
That's the Tax Justice Network. So, you know, and there are plenty of wealthy Democrats and hedge fund operators who contribute to the Democratic Party who are also making use of offshore havens to shelter income. This is not really a partisan political issue. Both parties have tolerated the growth of this industry over the last 30 years. The banks that play a major role in taking money for wealthy people around the world and putting in havens tax-free, you know, don't really discriminate between Republicans and Democrats. They have a lot of political influence in both parties. So this is really not, I think, just a Republican versus Democrat issue.
Well, but James Henry, again, an economist, lawyer, investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. And he was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Now, the price of offshore revisited was $21 trillion. That's $21 trillion of, as far as I can tell, essentially unproductive money that is equivalent almost what, it's not quite twice our national debt. But there's also, I think in your report, the indication was that it could be as high as $32 trillion, which would be twice the national debt, right?
Yeah. It's bigger than a bread box. I mean, we were shocked to find this number, but we were pretty careful about trying to use three different estimation methods to arrive at this. It's kind of like estimating the size of a black hole, because there's no direct light that you can cast on it that doesn't disappear. So we looked at one method was to look at the assets under management and deposits and custodial assets like brokerage accounts at the top 50 players in the international private banking market. And that added up to about $12.3 trillion. A second method was to look at how much unrecorded capital flows out of low and middle income countries. And we were able to build detailed economic models of those flows for 139 developing countries. Oddly enough, there's actually more data available from the IMF and the World Bank on developing countries with respect to capital flight than there is on rich countries. To get a global total, we also looked at the Bank for International Settlements data that it has on cross-border deposits by individuals. And that showed about $7 trillion just of bank deposits as of the end of 2010. So that's only a fraction of the total portfolio that investors would have. And you could scale that up to the global total using the fact that deposits are typically just 20 to 25% of the total portfolio. So the developing countries analysis showed that developing countries accounted for about a third of this 21 to 32 trillion, about $7 to $9 trillion. The banks alone had $12.3 trillion, and the BIS numbers showed that it was the global total was at least $21 trillion. That's, in the scheme of things, about 10 to 15% of global wealth, which is on the order of $200 to $220 trillion. But most of it accrues to the very top of the world wealth distribution, so it really does show that we've been understating inequality. We have about 10 million people on the planet, 0.14% of the population, that owns about 80% of the offshore assets and about 33%, a whole third of total financial wealth.
So only the banks know what's going on? I mean, I have noticed, because most of my beat is national security issues, and we know, for example, from back in the Yugoslav wars, when Clinton was in power, that Milosevic, who was the former central banker of Yugoslavia, when it split up, and he basically stole the treasury and parked it in Cyprus and a bunch of other banks. And apparently the National Security Agency, the eavesdropping people, have some facility or ability to track some of this money. And I don't know whether they froze it, but I understand that there was some economic warfare that went on and that goes on, you know, it is a weapon. In other words, it doesn't make any sense to invade a country and kill a bunch of people who are subject to some crooked dictator who's stolen them blind. It makes more sense to, if you can't take out the dictator, then at least take his money away, you know? So I believe...
Well, I assume our intelligence agencies are, sort of up to speed on a lot of this stuff. They're not sharing it with the rest of us, but... You know, when I took a look at the Marcos dynasty in the Philippines, he was in power from 72 to 86. And after he left, I went to the Philippines and looked at what had happened. In his case, he had used the Central Bank of the Philippines as a piggy bank, borrowed about $7 billion in the name of the Central Bank of the Philippines, debt that the Philippines is still servicing. The New York banks involved basically looked the other way as he transferred at least half of that money to Swiss banks. So, that was an example of dictator money. There's dozens of examples like that from Saddam Hussein and the Basha in Nigeria and, Dos Santos in Angola and, you mentioned Milosevic. But the problem is that these kleptocrats basically have a kind of impunity. So I mean, we knew full well that, for example, Mubarak in Egypt had accumulated billions of dollars offshore. Gaddafi had $100 billion offshore under his own family control. And, you know, these huge sums that are basically ripped off from the country and are sitting in Western investments. But it isn't, apparently it wasn't considered to be in U.S. interest to expose this while these people were in power.
So is there a name and shame regime? In other words, until you get the information, you can't really name and shame. Is that the problem?
Well, we've done a lot of naming and shaming. I think I've been, you know, involved in writing about this for 30 years. I think it's only now that we are beginning to get a kind of public outrage at this. There's a certain sense in which the public regards this as kind of, you know, with resignation. You know, what do we do about it? I mean, here's another dictator and another outrageous. You know, there's just case after case that you can look through the literature over the last 30 years and find these extreme examples, and then the regular tax evasion that's been exploding, even while we've been cutting taxes, is going along side by side. It's probably in the aggregate much larger. So I think what we need to do is to stop making this such a sensational story necessarily, but also to just look at the institutions that support it. Look at the banks, the law firms, the big accounting firms that are basically enabling all this activity, because none of the, there's a certain amount of grow your own kind of offshore evasion, but most of these people who are investing heavy amounts of money offshore, $30 million or more, about 100,000, we calculate people with that kind of income or wealth that they're sheltering offshore, they're not setting up their own offshore tax haven regimes. They're not setting up their own asset protection trusts or their shell structure. They're hiring very sophisticated banks and law firms to do this.
But isn't that the point, that these wealthy individuals, along with big Fortune 500 corporations, are essentially in bed with criminals in the sense that they're both in the same kind of financial whorehouse?
Yeah, I would, I've kind of been reluctant to brand these people as criminal associates. However, you see an example recently of HSBC, you know, the third bank on our list, a major UK bank, just did a deferred prosecution agreement with the Justice Department in which they admitted that they had been laundering money for the Colombian and Mexican cartels to the tune of $14 billion. You had Wells Fargo exposed running money exchanges in Mexico and helping the Mexican cartel launder billions and billions of dollars. Citibank exposed is doing the same thing. So, yes, it seems that there's certainly a lot of recidivism in this industry. And people have proposed just making an example of one of them. HSBC recently got off with a parking ticket of $1 billion fine. That sounds like a lot, but their profits are $20 billion. And so the notion of, you know, treating them kind of like we treated BCCI in the 1990s, a Pakistani bank that was thoroughly corrupt and engaged in all kinds of chicanery, we basically put them out of business. There's a case for making an example of one of these major banks or one or more of these major banks because they don't seem to learn from history.
Well, but the point that I was trying to make is that because prominent and wealthy individuals and big corporations are using these offshore facilities, that's the reason why you can't just go out after these criminals? Are the people who want to go after the criminals who have stolen all this money hamstrung by the fact that the money, in effect, is commingled with the so-called legitimate wealthy people and legitimate Fortune 500 companies?
They're all swimming in the same pond. And, the banks are spending, between 1990 and 2006, the financial services industry in the United States spent $6.8 billion on lobbying campaign contributions in Washington. That's an average of $2,200 per day per congressman. So So yes, they bought a lot of influence with that, and that's why when you look at the tax codes for the U.S. and the U.K. and Switzerland, they really are designed to attract foreign capital and you know, not to report it, not to tax it, to get it here and then not tell the source countries anything about it. Meanwhile, we're going after the Swiss, you know, for coming to the United States and targeting wealthy U.S. investors, but we have this double standard when it comes to developing countries. But you're right that there's this institutional framework,
right,
basically for which the big banks are the systems operators, and it's not these little havens around the planet. There's about 80 of them, but they're just conduits.
You know,
the final destinations are the great big banks.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, James Henry.
You're quite welcome.
Again, James Henry is an economist and investigative journalist and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and the Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about North Korea.